Zoning is State v. Loving. Council may approach.
I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time.
Again, this is State v. Loving. Good morning.
Good morning, Mayor. May it please the court, I'm Leslie Cavanaugh, Douglas County Assistant Public Defender, on behalf of my client, Jeffrey Loving. This case must be reversed. The trial court erred when it left out of the second-degree murder jury instruction the necessary language that the defendant did so without provocation under a sudden quarrel. And while I appreciate that the state recognizes that this is plain error, they are disingenuous when they say in their brief that there was no evidence that Jeffrey was not acting under the provocation of a sudden quarrel, and therefore the error is harmless. The record is replete with evidence of a sudden quarrel, a quarrel started by Theodore Loving, and that provoked a reaction by Jeffrey Loving. And that provocation rendered Jeffrey incapable of reflection. We know that the jury rejected this argument that the state now makes because Jeffrey, and their argument is that Jeffrey reflected upon the killing before it happened. We know this because they found him not guilty of first-degree murder. They were told that premeditation can happen in an instant. It may be so short as to be instantaneous. And the state strenuously argued this to the jury during their closing. And yet the jury found that Jeffrey did not, in an instant, reflect and premeditate upon the killing. Let's look at the facts. There was a sudden break in the relationship between Jeffrey and Theodore, according to the testimony of Dynasty Loving. Everything changed on July 1st. With the demand for the old drug debt and his whole mood, Theodore's whole mood and demeanor towards the two of them changed. That's on page 1022 and 1023. There was a sudden break in the relationship between Jeffrey and Theodore, according to Jeffrey's testimony. He testified that Theodore was the entire opposite of how he had acted around Jeffrey before, and that he had sent him texts implying that unless he got his, quote, MFing money, I was going to be killed. That's what he implied. Then Theodore orders a voicemail death threat to be sent to Jeffrey from a guy identified as Cousin Mike. That message said, as Jeffrey describes it, if Jeffrey didn't get his Uncle Theodore the money, quote, they knew that he was staying with his sister and that they'd come to my sister's house and kill everybody in the house, and they knew about the kids, specifically stating my sister and her kids. They state my name and they stated my uncle's name. Page 1153.
Was that voicemail also received in evidence?
It was, and it was played before the jury. Theodore checks up with Cousin Mike to make sure the message gets delivered. Jeffrey receives that voicemail message the morning of the shooting. He's so frightened that he goes with Mary Parfitt, his girlfriend, out to Dynasty Loving's workplace and plays her the voicemail. And they decide that Dynasty is going to contact their landlord's wife, who is an Omaha officer. The state in its brief erroneously states that Mary thought the voicemail threat was a joke. I straightened that out and recrossed. She testified that she thought the earlier texts were a joke. She never testified that the voicemail was a joke. You can read it at page 974 to 975. She stated that she heard the voicemail and it made her blood boil. She did not think it was a joke. However, at this point, the voicemail is a threat. Neither Dynasty, Jeffrey, or Mary know that it's an imminent threat. The only person who knows it's an imminent threat is Theodore. Theodore knows they received the message because he testified that Dynasty forwarded him that voicemail to him that afternoon. He contacts Cousin Mike and complains, "Why'd you put my name in there?" Theodore, knowing that his niece and nephew have received this death threat from an unknown male saying that money needs to be given to him or everyone will die, then finds another male, puts him in a car that he regularly drives, and he shows up at a time that he knows his niece's kids, and Jeffrey are going to be home without any notice to any of them that he's going to show up. Sudden. Theodore told police when they first encountered him that he'd gone over to Dynasty's house to collect a drug debt, and he also repeats that to his sister when he's at the police station. He's there to collect a debt. Oral. Theodore speeds through the intersection and drives up and blocks in Kirk Carter's car so that Kirk cannot escape and starts yelling at Jeffrey, quote, Jeff, I want my FMing money. You thought I was playing with your ass. I want my FMing money. Page 1171. Sudden, oral, with provocation. He points a gun at Jeffrey. Sudden, dangerous quarrel with provocation. Kirk Carter said he could see Jeffrey's body language change during the yelling. He'd never seen his friend Jeffrey look like that before. It was frightened. Age 639, he was under the influence of the provocation.
Can I interrupt you here?
Absolutely.
Just briefly. Apparently after the incident, the gun that Theodore supposedly had in the car, no gun was found, is that correct?
That is correct.
And so what was the explanation? Just conflicting testimony as
conflicting
to whether there
testimony,
was...
Conflicting testimony, and that's up to the jury. But that's a credibility issue. It doesn't go to whether there isn't any evidence of provocation under a sudden quarrel.
Was it your theory that I know there was some driving around that occurred and they didn't seek medical attention right away, that somehow during that time period the gun was disposed of in some way?
It was our theory. That's what we argued to the jury, that in fact he didn't take a direct path to the Sinclair station where he ultimately contacted 911. He claimed he couldn't contact 911 because his phone was dead, even though there's a phone charger right there in the car. So he had the ability to call, but claimed he couldn't, and took a circuitous route to Sinclair Station. We suggested that route was to dispose of the gun.
And I suspect you're going to get there, but isn't the problem that after this first encounter in front of Dynasty's home, Theodore left. He left the home and drove away, and then there's evidence that Jeffrey went to the side or the back of the house, and then there was another encounter when the shooting occurred. But there was some period of time that elapsed between that initial encounter and the shooting, and there's evidence that Theodore's driving away and that Jeffrey's following him with his gun.
And that's the state's argument. And the defense presented evidence, Your Honor, that while Theodore drives away, he only drives around to circle back. And according to Jeffrey, he testifies that he's turning around the corner and that Kirk Carter is yelling at him as he had gone in the backyard. They're coming back around. So the sudden quarrel is ongoing when he's coming back around. The threat is ongoing.
Is there testimony about the time lapse in that?
I think it's seconds. There isn't any really testimony, but you know, this is a backyard, and I think that the jury, and you can see from some of the evidence that was submitted from the exhibits, that it really is just the backyard, and then you can see that corner. So it was second.
Before you run out of time, let me ask you this question. Should we agree with you that the case needs to be remanded for a new trial? What other issues that you've raised need to be determined? And I'm thinking particularly about the evidentiary issue and the testimony he was not allowed to give about why he denied culpability when he was in the jail.
Thank you. That's the point I do want to get to, and that is that, as I raised in my brief, under Crane, he didn't have the ability to give a full picture as to the reasons why he made the statements he did on those phone calls from the jail. And that's concerning because the state, in its cross, spent a great deal of time confronting him with statements that he made on the phone without Jeffrey being able to put into context, here's why I did it. I know that fights go on in the jail. I know that Kirk Carter, this guy that I was with, was shot at shortly after I was arrested. And his shooter was put in my same mod. And I know that the phone calls are all being heard by people who are sitting right next to me. So I know that every conversation that I have is going to be heard. And so for my safety, I'm going to get on the phone and deny any of this.
Wasn't an offer of proof, though, as to some of it, it seems like we can see where the question's going. Mm-hmm. But as I don't recall from my review of the record in that section any offer of proof that was made as to a lot of the things that you're arguing now.
I will agree with you in part. There is, however, in our motion for new trial, these things that are offered in the court being able to reconsider. And one of the issues raised in our motion for new trial was the error that was made by the court were these things, and we went into, had they been allowed to go into evidence, this is what would have been presented.
But if there is a new trial granted, the trial may be conducted differently. So do we need to address it at this time?
Yes, because we'll go before the same judge who's probably going to rule the same way. So I do think this court does need to address that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much did we take her over? Okay, please add that to the state's time. Morning, Mr. Liss.
Good morning, Your Honor. May I please the court? Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appalachian State of Nebraska. If time permits, I will focus on the jury instructions as well as the exclusion of Loveling's testimony at trial. We maintain he's not entitled to relief on either claim. As far as the jury instructions, as set forth in our brief, we acknowledge that the district court did not properly instruct the jury regarding the interplay between second-degree murder and sudden quarrel manslaughter, but we do maintain that the error was harmless in this case because there was no evidence of a sudden quarrel.
So you concede it's plain error?
Yes.
Even though there wasn't, neither side objected to the jury instruction at trial, it's plain error.
I think under our case law, when you look at State v. Ronald Smith, State v. William Smith, State v. McGuire, State v. Trice, they called it plain error several times. In those cases, I don't see any basis.
But don't the cases say that the evidence on sudden quarrel doesn't have to be great evidence, it just needs to be slight, if there's any evidence to suggest it. So the standard's pretty low to say there was some evidence of sudden quarrel. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and that's exactly what Trice says. There was evidence here, although slight, there was potential evidence of a sudden quarrel, and it needed to be reversed and remanded. I think this case is a distinguishable, and really, with sudden quarrel, there are really two components. Number one, there has to be something that constitutes a provocation. And number two, that provocation must obscure somebody's reasoning to the point that they're acting without deliberation, reflection, judgment. We would submit that both components are not satisfied in this case. On the first one, if we look at the evidence, whether or not there actually existed a provocation here. On the day of the shooting, after he gets his voicemail, Loving does nothing to leave the house or to get his family out of his house. To the contrary, he stays, he cuts his hair, he hangs out. I think this refutes his assertion that he's in a complete sense of fear based on the voicemail. Later that day, when his uncle and Marshall Washington come to Dynasty's house, it's undisputed that neither Theodore nor Marshall Washington get out of that vehicle while Theodore and Loving are exchanging words. And then after Theodore and Marshall Washington drive away, Loving himself testifies that he goes around the house. He's out of sight. Per his own testimony, so there's clearly no sudden quarrel at that point in time.
Says he's out of sight because he's running away from a gun that's being pointed at him.
But he's behind the house.
That's his testimony.
Sorry?
That's his testimony, though.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But nonetheless, to the extent there was a perceived threat, it's gone. He's behind the house, out of sight.
But if the car comes back, it's not gone.
The car's
circling to come back.
It goes around the block. The evidence is undisputed to that effect as well. It goes around the block, and he then runs through a field nearly a full block to the car and fires 10 shots into it. It's our position that this is not like William Smith where, sure, in that case, he pursued the victim and reinitiated the fight, and then the circumstances change where because he got jumped all of a sudden, unforeseen circumstances, the whole dynamic of that changed.
But in that case, wasn't the victim in that case running away from him at the time that he pulled the trigger in William Smith?
Yes, but the focus of the analysis there and the existence of the potential sudden quarrel was the fact that the circumstances changed and that he was getting jumped and all of a sudden the victim's friends had jumped into this and found himself in a lopsided fistfight, whereas in this case, when we look at the situation, what changed? Just moments ago, supposedly Theodore had been in a car pointing a gun at him, and then he drives away. Now he's around the block at a stop sign.
Pointing a gun at him again.
Well, according to your testimony, right.
But we can't look at the credibility of the testimony, can we? We just have to look at, that's for the jury to decide.
True.
So don't we just have to decide whether there's some evidence indicating that the defendant acted on a sudden quarrel. Some evidence.
Right.
So how do we get past that here?
Well, moving past this argument about what actually happened here, let's assume for the sake of argument that this amounts to provocation. We then have to look at, does this provocation rise to the level that it would render somebody incapable of judgment, reflection, and deliberation? Well, no, his testimony alone, I think, refutes that in this case.
Do we have to make that decision, or does a jury have to make that decision? Based upon all of the evidence from all sides? Because, I mean, I'll grant you that we have all kinds of conflicting evidence, and frankly, virtually every witness changed their story somewhere during the course of the investigation to the trial, including the defendant. But, I mean, where in these four cases does it say that's our decision if some evidence exists?
Well, in two of the four cases where we don't have evidence of a sudden quarrel, they found no evidence.
Okay.
And I guess the point I'm making here is that we don't need to get into some sort of credibility determination here or even really make a determination, because his testimony on what was going on at these points in time was undisputed. He's asked, okay, when Theodore's first there supposedly pointing a gun at you, why didn't you shoot? He said, I didn't want to shoot. Okay, when you're outside behind the house, why didn't you call 911? I didn't think they could teleport there. Why didn't you leave with your sister? I didn't think we could load up the car seats in time and leave. All of these things, so he that's a mental process. He's going through options A, B, and C, reflecting on those, making a decision, thinking, I don't want to go with those courses of action. So in order for a sudden quarrel to be present, he has to be, circumstances have to be these out of his mind. He can't reflect. He can't exercise judgment. And he himself testified that he is. He's explaining his course of action, his mental process. He went through A, B, and C, and then chose D to run
the
fire.
But that A, B, C that you just described, if I'm recalling the testimony correctly, was why he left the house after he shot rather than going back in. That wasn't the mental process he went through before shooting.
As I recall, it was, because that would have been, I mean, once he'd already shot him,
was because he testified he didn't know if he'd shot anybody. He testified he shot, but he didn't know if he hit anybody.
Right.
And then he runs away, jumps in the car with Kirk Carter, and takes off. And my recollection, all that was in that scenario. All that testimony you just cited was in that scenario. Why didn't you protect your sister and her kids rather than running away? And so it seems like that analysis doesn't fit into the facts that you're arguing.
I could be mistaken exactly in the timeliness of that. I don't want to quarrel with you there because I don't recall exactly where that was. But nonetheless, you're still going to have the evidence about, well, when virtually the same exact circumstance was presented to you earlier and he's supposedly sitting there with a gun, pointing a gun at you, why didn't you shoot then? And he says, I didn't want to shoot. He's thinking about it. So even if we take out the 911 call and why didn't you leave with your sister? Well, the very same circumstances were just presented to him and he says, I didn't want to shoot. So he's exercising judgment. He thought about it. He had a gun in his pocket. Supposedly a gun is being pointed at him, and he's in an imminent threat, and he thinks about it and says, I didn't want to shoot. So what's changed? The fact that the car went around the block? Well, then he goes and initiates the additional confrontation. So we would submit there was not a sudden quarrel. There was nothing sudden about that. To the extent that the second confrontation became sudden, he created it. But you can't create your own sudden quarrel and then claim that you're surprised by it. So again, I think it's our position that that's where the sudden quarrel fails in this case. It's his burden to show that he suffered prejudice in this case, and I don't think they can, in light of his own testimony, which shows that he was exercising judgment, which would negate the existence of a sudden quarrel.
Let's talk about the cutting him off from testifying about the jailhouse phone calls.
Right. 11 claims the district court erred by not allowing to testify about his incarceration with and fear of Dante Wilson, who allegedly shot Kirk Carter, and by not allowing him to testify about his general fear of other inmates if he would have admitted to shooting Washington while he was in jail. As far as the first matter, his incarceration with in fear of Dante Wilson. We maintain that that's not preserved because there was no offer of proof on that issue at trial. As far as the second matter, the general fear of retaliation from other inmates, we would maintain that that was properly excluded on relevance grounds as set forth in our brief. I think the theory is too attenuated for him to have been able to get into other inmates' phone calls and thought processes, especially when that was not the theory asserted to the trial court on this basis of relevance. But in any event, even if there was any error here with the exclusion of his testimony on either or both of these matters, we would submit it was harmless for two reasons. Number one, he was, in fact, permitted to testify about his general fear of retaliation. That came in at trial. His trial counsel specifically pointed to that and argued that during closings. So they got that before the jury anyway. And then number two, the record reflects that aside from these jail phone calls, he lied to police and told them that he wasn't involved and that they had the wrong guy. So even if they could have come up with some explanation as to why he lied during these jail phone calls rather than claiming this was self-defense, well, the jury was still going to hear the fact that he lied to police and never claimed self-defense there. He claimed they had the wrong guy. So that evidence was properly admitted. They heard that evidence anyway. So I think for either or both of those reasons, even if there was any error with the exclusion of that evidence, it was harmless in this case. If there are no further questions, we would ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We ran appellate over, right? So there's no rebuttal left. Okay, all right. Thank you both. We will take the case under advisement. We appreciate you being here this morning.